have two brains in our head, and if you're really keeping count, there seem to be four. Together, separately, and in coalitions, they have a good deal to say about how we do what we do, what we like to do, and what we avoid like the plague. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations. Join us on this edition as we take a look at the whole brain with the man who brought us the concept. Ned Herman, welcome and thank you.
Good. Glad to be here.
I want to start not quite at the beginning, but a couple of thousand years back. Was Hippocrates the first to say, no, the seat of the human is not in the heart, but in the head? And actually, it seems to be a dual mentality. Was that him?
Yes, that there's documentation that he made that note on a patient's record, 450 B.C., and that was one of the transitional ahas, because many thought, as I think Aristotle did, that this is the seat of who we are.
The heart. We think there as well as
right,
feel.
Think, that's right. This, right. It's important to life, but it's not as important to thinking.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to make a huge leap up to a fellow named Roger Sperry, who from my reading of your book seemed to have successfully separated the hemispheres and identified them separately. Was it Roger Sperry who first did that and his research?
He was attempting to discover through a series of operations that was for the purpose of solving epilepsy, where they were splitting people's brains to reduce the seizure possibility, and then having split the brains to be able to access them to discover what they did different one from the other. And his surgeon, Joseph Bogan, was actually the one who suggested to Dr. Sperry that he attempt these very special investigations using new equipment to find out what the left hemisphere did differently from what the right hemisphere did. So he came up with a dichotomy.
Mm-hmm. And was this a sort of an aha moment, like Hippocrates? Where they said, oh my heavens, they do different things.
Yes, and it was such an aha moment that that it captured the mind of the public. And we've ended up essentially with hundreds of millions of people thinking in terms of the dichotomy.
Yes.
And for me, this stops short of a real understanding of the brain. But at the time, it was a major breakthrough, and it got my attention, and it caused me, it motivated me to continue the research I was doing.
Okay. This is Ned Herman, and as we talk together, we are, I hope, going to be taking a look at how the whole brain emerged in his thinking and in his work. This is Conversations. I think people will have a pretty quick notion of, oh yeah, that's left brain and that's right brain. But I'm not sure we really know when we say that, mm-hmm. what we're talking about. Can you give us a quick tour through what the left brain, as Sperry and his fellow researchers found, does, and what the right brain, as they found, does?
He broke it into two fundamental dichotic sets or pairs, and the left brain was the rational, it was the analytic and logical mode of processing, and also organized and sequential, linear.
This is three-piece suit stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Tradition, safekeeping, security. And the right brain was the imaginative, it was the synthesizing, intuitive, it was the feeling brain, it was interpersonal, humanistic. Mm-hmm. And they were also described as verbal and nonverbal, with the right brain being essentially nonverbal, metaphoric, and the left brain being verbal and articulate.
how come we're a left brain culture, or maybe species? What is it that has taken us off in one direction rather than the other?
I think that has a long history of achievement, of the Industrial Revolution, of doing things with machines, bottom line kinds of businesses that developed where proper performance, on-time delivery had its payoffs. And so business has emerged largely as left mode or left brain. But that's, of course, not what the population is. The population is, I believe, an exact distribution across first two, but in my technology, four.
Mm-hmm. The four brains we'll be talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. What I don't even know if this is answerable. Can you conceive of what we would look like as a culture if we were right brain? I see more Isadora Duncan. I see more floating silk and
It would be a very. I don't think we would have war. Okay. I think we would have more in the line of the flower children of the 60s. I think the 60s was an example of a right brain movement that was not well managed because they didn't really know what they were doing as a purpose. But I think the mentality of it had a lot of the ingredients of right brain. Some of the Eastern cultures have those qualities. I think in India you will find more of a right brain tilt. Not in Japan, because Japan has turned out to be an industrial, very successful country.
Well, the difference between Buddhism and Shintoism, which is tradition, ancestors, rather, and Buddhism's quite different. Yeah.
Yeah, well, and the honoring of life, the honoring of the life of a cow, and they walk down the street. Now, that takes a certain mental attitude to not only allow that to happen, but to accept it and to actually think of it in positive terms.
Mm-hmm. I'll go back to Roger Sperry at least one more time. In your book, and I should say off the bat so people know, the book is called The Creative Brain. It's published and distributed by Brain Books, which is part of the Ned Herman Group. And we're talking about the creative brain on this edition of Conversations. That worked rather well. Back to Sperry for the moment. He said, and is quoted in this book as saying, that we're a society that discriminates actively against right brain people. Can you give us again another snapshot of how that manifests? What happens to a right brain person in our society?
Well, they are not taken seriously. They are not considered candidates for important work. Even though there is work that has a right brain mentality, a business does not differentiate in that way. And so there are good employees who are essentially rational and predictable, and there are people who come to work dressed in the wrong clothes and want flexible hours and bring their baby with them.
We see all that as disruptive rather than additive.
Exactly. Now, some companies have gotten the message and now have daycare centers. Unfortunately, what happened in Oklahoma City is an example of this, that whole complex understood that young mothers had babies.
It's interesting, even beyond the fact of a baby being present in the building, it seems to open the door also for nurturing and empathy and connectedness, which is all right brain stuff.
And
yes.
You are legitimatizing it by that. You are honoring that. And we are making slow, it's glacial progress, but we're making progress.
I want to ask you, if you'll let me, about yourself. You very nearly had a career as an opera singer. You paint, you sculpt, you photograph. Your double major from Cornell was physics and music.
Music, yeah.
You're a right brain, left brain guy. You're what we would think of as a complicated fellow, and probably in some ways a good solid man to have on board and a real disruptive influence, I would think. Now, that's just me trying to find a convenient nutshell for this question. Did you come to the research that you have done for the past 40 years or so personally in some ways to find out where Ned Herman stood on the planet?
I think a lot of it was personal. And I did not feel as if I was making the level of contribution that I felt was in me. And I felt that the people I worked for did not see the whole me. Uh-huh. And when I got into art and discovered that I was able to do something that I always wanted to do with no training. I mean, I'm a totally untrained artist, and I've sold about 400 paintings. That said, there was something within me that I needed to know more about. That's when I discovered that creativity came from the brain. That seems so obvious, you know. Of course it comes from the brain, excepting nobody writes about it other than a few people like me. If you look at the books on creativity, they all talk about the psychology of it and miss the brain part of it.
As if it's more mystical than actual. Ooh, is that a possible way?
Yeah. They for a reason I don't understand, discount the synaptic, neural, mental, chemical part of the creative process. And we just, I just designed a workshop where we emulated Edwin Land inventing the Polaroid camera by walking around a big brain model, 8 feet by 12 feet, seeing how the different parts of the brain contributed to the creative process.
Okay. Let's look at the different parts of the brain. I'm wondering if we need to take a quick look at the triune brain theory.
Yes.
In order to get this?
That's the step.
Okay.
That Paul McLean of the National Institutes of Health, shortly after Sperry made his announcements about the specialized hemispheres, he proposed a different theory which was tied to the evolution of the human being over the course of history, that we started out with a reptilian brain, which then, by reason of the needs of the time, had to develop a more sophisticated brain, which was called the limbic system, the neomammalian, which was then later capped by the neocortex, or the hemispheres. So even today, as a baby is born, as the brain develops, it follows this same path.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with a reptilian, then the limbic system, and then the cerebral cortexes develop in each of us. So we emulate the evolution. Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is the term.
And that translates roughly. There were people dashing around for dictionaries here.
That we relive the evolution of the species.
In every individual.
In every individual.
Thing.
So
okay,
we all right. did that. Uh-huh. Okay, now.
But it's not just did that, it's do that.
Do that, yeah. Yeah. And we, in my work, what I identified was the role of the limbic system. For 100 years, we've known that that is the center of emotional processing. But that's just the beginning. And so the whole lower half of this four-quadrant model Yesterday we had the color cards, and the green and red color cards were the limbic system.
Okay.
And when that 1,500-person group held up those cards, you could see that half of them were green and red, and half of them were blue and yellow.
Yes.
Which says that the world is a composite whole brain, which I believe.
Let me explain for just a moment. Ned Herman comes to us in May of 1995 as the commencement speaker for the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he did an experiment with not just all the graduating students, but with the faculty and with the parents and friends. Everyone gathered in the Patty Gymnasium for commencement to see how people use their brains and are used by their brains in life. I guess that's a fair way to put it.
Or what turns them on and what turns them off.
Very nice. Yes, and actually the desired result of this experiment was to find out what turns people on and what turns people off.
Yeah.
Ned Herman with us on this edition of Conversations. Now tell us how this limbic system, which you say is also not quite hemispheric, but it is.
Oh, it is.
It is, okay.
Well,
hemispheric is the right word.
It has two halves.
It has two halves, all right.
Therefore, the notion of dominance is that when you have pairs, it's very unusual that the pairs would be equal. It's almost preordained that they would be asymmetrical and different. And so the reason the two hemispheres connected together so they can talk to each other, they do different things. So do the two halves of the limbic system.
And they do different things in ways that complement each other from neocortex to limbic system and from hemisphere to hemisphere and half to half.
And both have a cortex. For the brain to think, it has to have a cortex. So the four structures in the brain that have a cortex are the two hemispheres, left, right, and the two halves of the limbic system, left, right. And so feeling is thinking. Now, this is a tough thing
for the limbic system.
The limbic system,
all
yeah.
Right,
when
ahead.
We feel, we can feel something, we can intuit something. In those cortices, and that is a neural synaptic event.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So
I'm getting that. Feeling is thinking.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's just as legitimate as rational thinking.
Yes. What
now,
we think of as higher thinking.
Well, people who think rationally have a problem with that because they cannot conceive of feeling which turns them off and which they reject typically can be thought of at the same level as their pure logical, analytic, rational thought.
Which is, quote, higher thought. This is where what Sperry is telling us, that we discriminate.
Right, higher thought, and actually it isn't.
Yeah.
It tends to be thought of as intellectual and cognitive, and the limbic part of it tends to be thought of as visceral and gut.
Animal.
Yeah, animalistic, sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also extremely powerful, because it can totally override any rational thinking process. That when you get into a state where emotion is involved, rational thinking goes out the window. And so in many decision situations, it is actually the limbic system that's in control.
Now, we tend to think of that as a weakness, I think, in this culture.
But this culture would call that a, you know, a lower level of thinking, a weakness, you're resorting to your gut now.
But you might say, rather, that puts intuition to work and puts sensitivity to work as a full tool.
And intuition is just as valid as rational thinking. And in my work with chief executive officers, I've discovered that they are typically more whole than other occupations, and that a number of key decisions that they make are based not on fact, but on gut, on intuition.
We think of entrepreneurs as gutsy people, men or women, gutsy people.
Well, risk people.
Yeah.
That's a different form of gut.
This would be a good time then to take us on a quick tour of the four quadrants, mm-hmm. so people can get some identification with.
Okay, the A quadrant, which I have a color code for this, is blue, is the rational, logical, analytic, technical, quantitative. It's where engineering is done. It's where finance is done. Chemistry is done. And going counterclockwise, the lower left, a green quadrant, is the organized, is the sequential, detailed, status quo, safekeeping, traditional quadrant. And we do bookkeeping there.
Mm-hmm.
We do proofreading there.
Mm-hmm.
We put up smoke alarms there. We buy insurance policies.
I like the way you're saying this, because it's not just where the accountant locates himself or the insurance person locates herself, but each of us does those functions.
Yes.
Okay, good.
You know, and we do our checkbook and we buy insurance because it's important in certain situations to do that.
In the B quadrant.
Yeah, okay. So then moving around this way again, we come to the lower right C quadrant, where the color is red, emotional, humanistic, interpersonal, spiritual. And I differentiate between the spirituality of us individually and our religious aspect. Two different things. So one is ritual, the other one is there are a lot of people who are very spiritual who don't actively participate in a religion. Then the final quadrant, yellow, upper right D, is the imaginative, experimental. Where a lot of what I was doing yesterday was up there because it was a big experiment. This would be where entrepreneurs function. This is risk. This is future-oriented. This is where fantasy takes place. Dreaming.
Vision.
Vision.
Yeah.
And when a company prepares a vision statement, it typically has those qualities to it, as opposed to operational planning. Strategic planning would be yellow. Operational planning will be green.
Ned Herman is with us on Conversations. We're taking a look at the brain. Do we all move around the four quadrants depending on what our chores need is, or are there quadrants we prefer and quadrants we avoid, or all of the above?
All of the above. We tend, by reason of the two sets of paired structures, which are asymmetrical, to develop dominances or preferences, just as our eyes are dominant one, different from the other, our hands, our feet, so are our brains. And so it would be unusual that they would be exquisitely balanced. It's much more the case that we have a tilt, that we have a preference. Now, the solution to being whole is to be situational, so that even if you don't prefer green to balance your checkbook and to do your homework and buy the insurance policy and put batteries in your smoke detector, that situationally you can do that. That you you take a half an hour and you do it. You just don't spend the day there. You don't devote your career to that. But you do it because it is important to you.
If I'm a visionary woman and I'm out there all the time thinking of new ways to transform the planet, am I also likely to remember my smoke detector battery?
Probably, if you have good survival instincts, you will remember that or be reminded of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then not do it the first time, but maybe the third time, you will remember to buy one and stick it in. Uh-huh. But that's being situational. People think of me as being very whole-brained. I'm not. My profile, it tilts enormously towards this yellow, but I'm also a scientist in the sense that I'm very good in that blue, technical, logical, scientific mode, and I'm working hard at developing my interpersonal skills and my human qualities with my family cheering me on. But the green is clearly my least preferred, but I'm very good at it.
Translate that, please.
Well, because it was necessary for me yesterday, I did an enormous amount of very detailed homework in diagnosing and looking at each major. There were many, 91 majors, and positioning that correctly, and going through all of those very detailed, painful, sequential kinds of things to put together the experiment correctly. And so it was difficult for me, but it was so important to me to do it that I did it.
So for you, and this is a clue for us, priority can create follow-through willingness.
Well, it can create motivation. Do something that you wouldn't normally want to spend a beautiful Saturday afternoon doing.
Right.
But I did.
Willing to, because you see that end, which is a visionary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Ned Herman is with us on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at the whole brain, how it works, where it comes from, and how to access it on Conversations. My guest graduated from Cornell in 1943 with a double major in music and in physics. He went to work at General Electric Company and began learning how, from his own research, to train the people at General Electric to do their best. He then created the Ned Herman Group, which is doing research to help all of us do our best. This is Conversations, and I'm Susan McGinnis. Ned, it's, again, very nice to have you with us. Now, this is, I suppose, the chicken or the egg question. Do I come onto the planet, do you come onto the planet, hardwired to be a certain kind of thinker, a certain kind of feeler?
The experiences of life have a stronger influence on who we become than our genetic start. I don't believe that many of us, there's no doubt that some of us are, but most of us are not pre-programmed, that the nurture is more important in our development than it is the nature. And I have a number of 70-30 that on the average is how I would describe the impact of the two.
Nurture being what
happens to our parenting, our schooling, our society, our friends, our experiences provide 70% of who we are.
So somebody said to you when you were wandering around the house at two, warbling, Ned, you're singing, that's good. And you were nurtured for your singing, or...
Yes, and my mother recognized that and got me a vocal teacher at a very early age.
So it's not only a reward, Ned, you're singing, that's good, but then it's encouragement to go on
absolutely.
And try this.
Okay. Yeah, and then affirmations of being able to do it.
And now, if somebody had said to you, well, that's not very logical, would you, do you think, shut down parts of yourself?
Well, I am perfectly capable of being logical, and since I accept the non-logical as being, and let me give you a very specific local example. Yesterday, we had a handout of the models that I've created.
Right.
That came to me in a dream about 4 months ago, that I knew there would be a program, and I knew there might be a centerfold opportunity. And so I conceptualized in a dream that this would be the basis of my commencement speech. Uh-huh. Now, yesterday morning, in a dream, and I do this deliberately every day and have practiced it for years, I evolved the notion of waving your card if it was passionate, holding it up straight if you were aligned, and jiggling it if you were not aligned. That was yesterday morning's dream.
Fine.
Now, I trust that at the level that I stood up and did it, and it worked.
Uh-huh.
So, even though I had done a lot of homework, some of my final behavior was based on dreams.
Okay.
And that's legitimate. I think dreams are a very, very important part of our thinking capability.
You're also telling me that the understanding, the whole brain concept gives us of how we do work and might potentially work can help us access more and more of ourselves. I'm thinking of people I know who say, I don't do math.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I open a book, I fall asleep. I couldn't sing a note if I tried. I just don't get along with people. I'm trying to find my way around the quadrants here. I don't know whether I've fully done it.
Yeah,
but
so
that willingness, practice, experimentation, etc., can help us.
Well, facilitating people into that so that they have an affirmation is a major technique that I use. Teaching people how to draw, not so that they could become artists, but so that they were affirmed with that ability.
Uh-huh.
And that essentially validates their upper right quadrant. So there are families of things, and if you validate one, then other members of the family become available too, like being able to visualize. Taking people on a guided fantasy, they say, I can't do that, but then they can.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, I'm currently teaching senior executives in a process called strategic thinking, which they need to do strategic planning. Unfortunately, they try to do strategic planning without understanding they need to be able to think strategically. So we are, and it doesn't work. So we are taking them through experiences, including using Native American techniques of having them discover parts of their mental capability they didn't think they had, thinking metaphorically, using nature, animals, as metaphors for products and competitors.
Tell me a little more about that so we can, to use the word, visualize how this is working.
Okay. I have them do some creative writing around them becoming a buffalo for a day or a porcupine. You've just spent a day as a porcupine. Write about that.
Uh-huh.
Write about the behavior. Write about getting food. Write about mating. Write about your relationships with other animals.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, having done that and having done it extremely well, amazingly so, all right, now select an animal that represents your chief competitor.
Uh-huh. As a porcupine, as a...
Or they select an animal, and it could be a snake.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And write about that. Crawl into the skin of your competitor through a metaphor. Now select one for your major client. And we discovered that some of the executives picked animals that were hostile. And that was because they did not have the proper relationship with the client.
Uh-huh. But if you had just asked executive number one, do you have a hostile relationship with your client?
No, he wouldn't have said that.
Yeah, I
see. But by having picked a rat, he's before he knows it, he has disclosed the reason that there is a hostile relationship. And we then help them understand that that's counterproductive.
But you also help them to understand what tools they might use to find better
those are thought processes that they now have tested to a level of affirmation for them. I mean, they're saying, wow, hey, this stuff works.
Right.
It's weird, but it works.
It's all very right brain.
Yeah. And then I have them build models using creative materials of their company and their major client, and to show the connections between them using creative materials. They end up with no connections. And so after a day of other things, I ask them to remodel. Now there are connections.
Huh.
They had not sufficiently thought through in any kind of a holistic visual way the relationship that they had with their client. And through these techniques of accessing parts of their mental capability that they don't use, but they're sitting there available to them, and if you facilitate them into that use, it then becomes a transferable capability.
Mm-hmm. This is Ned Herman. If you're wondering how he knows about how... No, I want to say this a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. If Ned Herman developed an instrument, 120 questions. It was developed in... process, as I understand it, the development began when you were back at GE, right?
Yeah, right.
And through a series of tests and uses of the instrument, he found one that worked very well. The instrument is 120 questions asked in all sorts of different ways to find out what part of your brain you're using most, what parts of the brain you prefer, are comfortable with, what parts you reject, what parts you use grudgingly. It's all that kind of a fair characterization.
Yeah.
Learning that about someone, then he can help that person or work through the Ned Herman group or, to be honest, reading The Creative Brain, the book, can help someone understand how to make use of their brain differently or in a more enhanced way. Is that helpful?
Yes.
All right. Ned Herman is our guest on Conversations. Go ahead.
And that translates almost immediately into not only thinking styles, but learning styles.
This is the next question I was going to ask you. You did an experiment with the engineering school at the University of Toledo that I'd like you to tell people about because it pulls us into learning and teaching and also into, I think, with a side mirror, how institutions work with the people that they bring into their institutions.
Well, the dean of engineering of that school was not satisfied with the outcome. He felt that they were not sufficiently creative in how they taught, that they were not delivering the product. So he invited me to work with faculty initially. And I positioned the faculty physically in an amphitheater based on their thinking style. And it was very dramatic because they were almost all A quadrant blue thinkers. And there were about 50 people in that category, 20 people in green, nobody in red, and about four people in yellow. And so the faculty was highly skewed. He then asked me to develop an experiment in which we would profile all incoming freshmen to find out the composite of the incoming freshmen, and they were amazingly equally distributed in the four quadrants, almost perfectly distributed. The faculty, of course, was not. We then devised a longitudinal study in which we would do this each year for 4 years, measuring the incoming freshmen and the outgoing seniors. And what we discovered was that the outgoing seniors were a fraction of the incoming freshmen, and that they emulated the faculty, that the course of study, the design and delivery of the engineering learning as done by the faculty, which was tilted, the learning was tilted and did not provide a whole brain freshman class or a whole brain school with a whole brain learning experience.
Were you surprised by this?
I was not surprised by it. I think that the university in general was surprised by it, not the dean. I think we both knew what was happening. The extent of it was dramatic.
Did all those yellows and reds just wash out, drop out, fail?
All of the above. They failed, they were thrown out, they left in disgust, they couldn't stand it anymore. And some of them struggled for 3 years, and a few made the grade, but I can't imagine somebody with that difference in their mental preference ever learning what was intended to learn. And that's a key issue, is what was intended. Mm-hmm. Did you get what we intended, or did you get something else? Mm-hmm. And the cost of this is just enormous, and in the sweat investment and the financial investment is just enormous.
I have two questions at once, and so I'll ask you them, and then you can answer whichever one comes first for you. Does this mean to you that, A, Toledo needs to, and by example, other schools, rethink how they teach, and B, that engineering loses vision and heart when it doesn't teach to the abilities and inclinations of people who are more located in what you think of as yellow and red?
The answer is yes to both.
Yeah.
They are moving in that direction. That the effect of this is so dramatic that it's now being shared with other engineering institutions. And that dean has now moved to a larger institution and is doing the same thing with that larger institution. And so the work is still going forward at his original University of Toledo and also this Northwestern Technology.
Mm-hmm.
And he is sharing, writing papers, talking at engineering conventions about it, and it's gaining momentum. Now, the same thing is true of many other subjects. I think medical education is identical to this, with the additional problem of having years of brutalized internship.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you end up with are survivors. That's not the best way of training people.
Mm-hmm. Now, how would an engineering institute or a medical institution go about learning how to teach to the whole brain when all their training is to teach to the quadrant?
Yeah, well, of course, the answer is, and there is a technology that I've developed to do this, that every key learning point, and let's say that in a one-day learning situation there are let's say, 10 key learning points that you die for. You know, there may be 20 others, but there are 10 you die for. Those are delivered in ways that emulate each quadrant, so that that learning point is delivered first with a handout, pre-reading.
Visual.
Second with a graphic, a visual metaphor of the learning point in the form of a film clip or an animated series or of slides. An exercise in which teams or pairs actually engage in the learning point through discussion or through role play or through some kind of an interactive thing. And then there may be a data-based version of the learning point. Huh. And these would be distributed in different places at different times, but they all convey what was intended in a different mode. Now, the results of this are remarkable because now more of the people in the class get it as intended. And I think the assumption has got to be that every teacher and every institution makes is that each class is a composite whole brain.
Uh-huh. Each roomful.
Each roomful.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever. And it turns out that this is true. I have data, hundreds of thousands of pieces of data, even including a high school or a group of gifted and talented children or a group of people at University of Toledo or at Shell Oil or General Electric. And although it's not always exquisitely balanced, all of the quadrants are represented in every class that I'm aware of. And certainly yesterday we had a brilliant demonstration of this.
Mm-hmm. A rainbow room.
A rainbow room.
Yeah, yeah. It, this is too large a question, again, so answer its part. Is the whole brain transformation one that will simply change business and education as we know it, if at our glacial pace we move towards?
I think it could. In the domains that we are talking about, and I am really a missionary and a revolutionary in trying to bring this message to all of the potential applications, and this includes issues like marriage, issues like how you bring up your kids, issues like, well, our minister wrote an article on a whole brain sermon to show you how far this can go. Because you can imagine that you could, now you've got a congregation that's a composite whole brain. The intended learning of the sermon now needs to be delivered in ways that everybody gets what was the intentionality of the minister.
Huh. Go back to the family. You have an example in your book about, I think it's called Weird John.
Weird John, yes.
Yeah. A man came to you, and tell us this story.
It was a father who came to me after he learned about my work and said, Ned, I'm having problems with my kid, my older son, and I've essentially given up. I don't know what to do, and I don't like the direction he's going in. I don't like his friends. I don't like his music. I don't like the way he wears his hair. I think he took the wrong course in school. You know, help me.
Boy, does this sound familiar. I mean, yeah. I can hear parents all over the listening audience.
Would you profile John and also profile the whole family, because I think all of us would like to be involved. So I did that. And gave him multiple copies. He then reported what he did. But when he first saw the composite of the family, with John being very different from what was a tribe, the tribe was left mode and John was strongly yellow D quadrant, he said, "My God, what have I done?" He then sat the family around the kitchen table and passed out the profile, the composite, and there was dead silence until finally one of John's brothers said, kind of tentatively, as if for the first time he saw John in a different light, he said, "Hi, John." Welcoming John in as a member of the family, because they had ostracized him. There was tribal punishment because he was, they considered him weird. He was not weird, he was just different.
Well, and he wouldn't get in line. I'm sure that was the family. Yeah, if he'd just straighten up.
Right. Yeah. He could have solved the problem if he had bitten his lip and behaved the way the family behaved.
Which meant not being himself.
But he couldn't. He couldn't do that.
Yeah.
Now he married a woman who emulated his mother. And opposites attract. And he needed to have, to make him whole, he needed to have a mate that provided other thinking style preferences that together with him, with his, made a whole.
Do we tend to do this?
Oh, absolutely.
I have
thousands of data, pieces of data on married couples, and they are 90% opposites. Now, living together, unmarried couples are homogeneous. That is, they are the same.
Right.
Largely the same, and it's the very sameness that does not require the legitimatizing of the relationship through a marriage contract, and it is the very difference that requires a marriage contract, because it's unthinkable that these two different people could ever get together on any other basis.
Which means you have to make a formal commitment to stay together to...
If you're that different...
Transcend your differences.
Yeah, if you're that different... I mean, I'm speculating now.
Right.
But
right.
If you're that different, then you have to honor that with a formal arrangement.
I see.
The people who are so comfortable with each other that these things don't matter. I mean, hey, come on, we don't have to do that. And so those relationships tend to be transient.
Easier to be and easier to
leave. Easier to be and not to be.
Is understanding how your mate, spouse in this case, differs from you important in a peaceful marriage, rather than just wishing that person
absolutely. I think in the marriage counseling application of my work, it's amazing to discover that two people who have been in marriage counseling for 3 years or 5 years, using standard psychiatric or psychological sorts of therapies, suddenly see their opposite profiles on a common grid, and one of them looks at it like the wife and says, "Oh, you're different."
Oh, it's not just that you're stubborn.
Oh, I thought you were doing it on purpose.
Yes, yeah.
I thought this behavior was deliberate. This is just that you think differently. Oh my heavens, that makes a difference. Huh. I mean, it's amazing.
It's interesting. Your research shows that the more you know, the more you can do. Mm-hmm. Live with, tolerate, understand, create.
Yeah, I think it's fundamental to having a of being situational, and that's what the answer is down the road, is that the answer to wholeness, which would allow you to optimize how you function in many different domains, whether it's marriage or whether it's at the university or at work, that you are situationally able to take advantage of all the mental capabilities that you have.
All of your parts,
yeah.
This has been fascinating. People are going to want to know, I think, how to access, so to speak, this information. There are four books. Two of them are out. One is a delightful monster. I say that
lovingly.
Yeah, I say that lovingly. It's almost 500 pages. It's called The Creative Brain. It comes from Brain Books. It's in its fifth printing. It's been translated into three languages. It was self-published by Ned Herman and the Ned Herman Group, not because publishing companies didn't want it, not because people didn't think it had important information, but because Ned said, I want to format it the way people think, the way people see, the way people feel, the way people will understand. And so it's long and thick, and the illustrations are on one side, because you see them from one side of your brain, and the facts and figures are on another side, because you see them from another side of your brain. So it's not going to fit comfortably into the bookshelf. You have to understand that if your thing is a neat bookshelf, you don't want this book. The Creative Brain from Brain Books is from the Ned Herman Group. Grab a pencil, and I'll tell you how to get a hold of that group if you'd like. The other books, A Few Things Everybody Should Know About the Brain, also published by Brain Books. In Process, The Whole Brain Business Book, which may come out from McGraw-Hill. And also in process, What Should I Be When I Grow Up? The Ned Herman Group is at 2075 Buffalo Creek Road. Is that Lake Lure?
Lake Lure.
L-U-R-E, North Carolina. And the zip is 28746. Once again, 2075 Buffalo Creek Road, Lake Lure, L-U-R-E, North Carolina, 28746. The Herman Brain Dominance Instrument is a 120-question inventory resulting in a profile of the individual's mental preferences. 2 million of them have been given. There's 120,000 result database segregating people by occupation, mental preference, and the like. So there's a lot of data available. And the Herman Brain Dominance Instrument can also be acquired from the Ned Herman Group. This has been a fun hour. I want to thank you a lot for spending it with us.
I'm delighted.
Good. This is Conversations. Ned Herman has been our guest. I'm Susan McGinnis. I want to thank you all for joining me, and especially Ned Herman. And I hope you join me again next week.